Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming tonight. It's a real pleasure to be here and to welcome you to this event. I'm Naomi Oreskes, the provost of Sixth College. So thank you for coming tonight to hear our distinguished professor, our distinguished speaker, and former Harvard president, Derek Bach. As most of you know, this year is the 50th anniversary of the founding of UC San Diego. One of the distinguishing features of our campus is its undergraduate college system, envisioned by Roger Revelle as a means to bring the virtues and values of a liberal arts college to the great university, which he hoped would grow in this space. As part of the 50th anniversary celebrations, the Council of Provosts wanted to do something to acknowledge, celebrate, and reaffirm the importance, the centrality of undergraduate education in the mission of this great university, which has indeed grown in this place. In the past year, we have heard the opinion voiced at times, sometimes in high places, that perhaps a broadly based education is a luxury we can no longer afford. We've heard the idea expressed that in the 21st century, a liberal arts education might be just a little bit quaint, that perhaps the time has come for education to be made of sterner stuff. So when the Council of Provosts thought about whom we might invite to challenge that idea, to speak to the enduring value of education broadly construed, the answer was to us immediately obvious. For I think it is fair to say that no one in the United States has been a clearer, more articulate, or more persuasive spokesman for the enduring value of a liberal arts education than tonight's guest, Derek Bach. So now to introduce Derek Bach, I'm pleased to introduce our Chancellor, Marianne Fox. Chancellor Fox, as most of you know, is an internationally renowned chemist and academic leader, recently recognized with the highest honor that can be bestowed by the government of the United States on a scientist or engineer, the National Medal of Science. As Chancellor, she has greatly strengthened this campus as one of the leading institutions of higher education and research in this country, in particular guiding the expansion of campus research mission this year to surpass $1 billion in research funding. Before I introduce the Chancellor, I'd just like to thank a few people, the Helen Edison Lecture Series, and particularly Edie Monk, for helping us to organize and publicize the event tonight. The Council of Provosts for making this event possible, both logistically and financially. And I'd also like to single out the work of my fellow colleague and chair of the Council of Provosts, Susan Smith, and her staff, particularly Bryn Caffrey, who did so much to make sure that all the details of President Bach's visit came together. So now to introduce President Bach, please help me welcome the Chancellor of UC San Diego, Marianne Fox.
Well, good evening, everyone. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce Dr. Derek Bach. He is a lawyer and an educator who served as the 7th dean of the Harvard Law School and the 25th president of Harvard University. He is also the author of numerous acclaimed books, including The Shape of the River, which has been called the most ambitious and authoritative study on the effects of affirmative action in higher education. I know it's affected me that way. The book details the impact of race-sensitive admission policies, including the impressive admissions policies developed by Harvard, and that the diverse body can place each other in a place where you can live and work with people of other races. Dr. Bach has been a vocal advocate for student participation in public service. By the end of his presidency, more than 60% of Harvard undergraduates were engaged in some form of volunteerism, an area in which UC San Diego also excels. We applaud his efforts and have followed in his footsteps here at UC San Diego with the launch of our 50th anniversary initiative, Volunteer 50. Dr. Bach's studies span numerous subjects, such as the effect of the marketplace on universities, and the ability of the United States government to cope with the nation's domestic problems. We are thrilled to have Dr. Bach here with us tonight. Please join me in giving him a warm welcome.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on such an important occasion for this university. I appreciate, as a someone who grew up in Southern California the chance to come back here and to join in your celebration for what has really been a spectacular 50-year run in your since the university was founded. I mean, it's really quite remarkable what you've accomplished in that period. I mean, you have a university that's vaulted into the ranks of the 20 most distinguished universities by general academic opinion in the United States. You have 25,000 undergraduates. You have a world-class faculty. You have buildings that have sprouted like mushrooms. And truly, you have played a very important part in the building of what is clearly, and I hope will always be, the greatest system of public higher education in the United States, and I dare say the world. As I thought about all you'd accomplished in the first 50 years, I couldn't help contrasting your accomplishments with the progress of my own university at a similar point in its history. In our 51st year, we were proud to enroll exactly 22 new freshmen, and that was a record that would stand for another 30 years. We had a faculty consisting of two tutors, one building, which subsequently burned down, unfortunately. I think our difficulties were caused by a rather rocky start, which I'm sure was nobody's fault, one of those things that happens in the life of universities. Our first president, who was called a master in those days, the first president was criminally charged with beating a tutor almost to death. And this, I think, is unusual, even by American higher education standards. His wife was also accused of watering the students' beer and putting goat's dung in their pudding. In any event, they both absconded shortly thereafter, taking part of the endowment with them. At that point, I think people got somewhat discouraged and closed the institution down for 2 years, and so it really started belatedly and from a rather bad beginning. We had only one distinction. We were universally acclaimed to be the finest university in America. But even that was somewhat tarnished by the fact that, of course, we were the only university in America, so you could equally well call us the worst university in America, which certainly we had a number of good arguments in favor of that position as well. But I won't belabor this any longer. It's really kind of painful to contrast what we were able to do in 50 years and what you have accomplished, but there it is. And so I thought I'd go on to my topic, which is not quite to proclaim the virtues of a liberal education, but is something I think is very important to all of us who care about undergraduate education. To talk about what I think is the most significant controversy now going on about the future of higher education. It's rather strange in a way that there should be a controversy about undergraduate education, that there should be so many complaints and there should be reforms being suggested that are really quite far-reaching. Because after all, we all know that higher education, which undergraduate education is the most substantial part in terms of the numbers of students, we know that higher education is one of the jewels in America's crown, that 17 of the top universities in the world, according to not American scholars, but a group of Chinese scholars, seconded by another independent group of English scholars, 17 out of the 20 top universities in the world are located in the United States. We know, too, that America is the country of choice for foreign students. It attracts more foreign students by a substantial margin than any other country. We know that our system is being increasingly emulated all around the world. in Asia as well as in Europe. They are introducing a structure of degrees not unlike our own, a system of graduation, graduate schools not unlike our own, and in even teaching courses in English, and certainly coming over in droves to study how we manage higher education so that they can do something similar in their own countries. And we also know that parents and students who are polled periodically on this subject give very high marks to higher to undergraduate education. And yet, as I say, I think undergraduate education at this point in time is the most heavily criticized, with the most far-reaching criticisms and far-reaching reforms being suggested of any aspect of American higher education. And the reason for that is that I think there are, despite all its strengths, there are rather disturbing signs of trouble in paradise. For one thing, graduation rates from college in this country have stagnated now for over 30 years. We, for 150 years, America was the best educated country on earth, and we owe a lot of our success and our prosperity to that fact. But now, for the first time, a number of countries have surpassed us in the percentage of young people who manage to earn college degrees. And for the first time in our history, young Americans today who are enrolled in college will be no better educated, no more frequently educated than their parents. That's not ever happened in our history. There's also, as you know, widespread concern about the cost of college. The tuitions have been going up substantially faster than inflation for a great number of years. That's caused quite a bit of distress and complaint among parents, and it has prompted many officials to ask, now, what are families and what indeed are taxpayers getting in exchange for all the money that they pour into higher education? Now, I think we have to confess, if we are honest, that for decades no one has known very much about what students are getting out of their undergraduate education. But at last, some evidence is beginning to come in, and it's not all favorable. There are 500 colleges in the United States that agree to administer to their students something called the Collegiate Learning Assessment Test, the CLA, which is really by far the most sophisticated test of writing and of critical thinking and of progress in writing and critical thinking among undergraduates. So with 500 colleges, you have quite a sample cross-section of American undergraduate education. And also, critical thinking and writing happen to be the two most important objectives of undergraduate education. Over 90% of all American professors believe that critical thinking is not only important, it is the most important advantage that you are supposed to get out of higher education, and writing is not far behind. And so it's somewhat disturbing to find that this test, which is not a short answer test, it's not a standardized test that is sort of graded by machine. It's a test of essay questions that try to give a pretty good idea of students' writing and certainly of students' ability to think about the kind of problems that they would face in real life. It shows an average gain of half of a standard deviation in both writing and critical thinking. And for those of you who are as ignorant about statistics as I am, I should say that what a half a standard deviation means is that if you have an average student who enters college and takes a test on critical thinking and writing with his fellow freshmen, and finishes, of course, being an average student at the 50th percentile. After studying for 4 years, that same student, were he to come back, or she to come back, and with a comparable group of freshmen, that student would score at the 67th percentile. Well, that's progress. But it's not a great deal of progress to move from the 50th to the 67th percentile of entering freshmen after having 4 years of undergraduate study to improve those vital skills. More worrisome still, 36% of the people taking the test made no appreciable progress at all in their writing or critical thinking as a result of 4 years of study. And the gains, I should say, this is not something that happens in some other remote part of undergraduate education that we never encounter here at UCSD. These roughly similar gains are about the same throughout the height and depths of the academic hierarchy in this country, in selective colleges as well as in community colleges. Now, one reason for these rather modest results may have to do with the amount of time students study. And we've got now, for the first time, some pretty good data on that. Looking back to when they first started inquiring into how much time students spend studying, which was about 1920, the authors find that there was substantially no change of any significance between 1920 and 1960. Since 1960, however, there has been a 40% drop in the amount of hours each week that the students on average spend on their homework. And if you keep up with the way things are done in the college generation, you know that much more in the past, studying is likely to consist of something that psychologists call multitasking. You are reading a book or looking at a problem set, but you're also listening to music, you're twittering, you're texting, you're surfing the internet, you're doing a variety of other things, perhaps, that certainly do not contribute to the quality of time that you're putting in on it. And these figures are not just figures for some other segment of higher education that we don't see much of here on this campus. The figures I've given you, I don't know about UCSD, but they are very similar to those that have been set forth in detail for Berkeley, which I'm sure has a student body somewhat comparable to your own. So once again, these are figures that obtain up and down the hierarchy of higher education. And these results are more than usually troubling because college graduates today, whether they know it or not, are no longer have the luxury of competing for jobs and careers only with their fellow graduates here in the United States. American companies are increasingly hiring scientists, financial analysts, computer programmers, web designers, and much else from overseas, where they can find people who are quite competent who work for a good deal less money. 500,000 tax returns now of Americans are made out not by accountants spread out in towns across the country. They are made out by people in Bangalore, in India, who, now whether that's resulted in more prosecutions from the Internal Revenue Service, I don't know. But the fact is that jobs that used to go to American accountants are now being farmed out to people with college educations in India. So that one corporate CEO recently said, and I quote, "Any job you can think of now can be done by someone on the other side of the world for much less money." So our college graduates are no longer going to be able to compete with this international competition on grounds of salary. They're certainly going to be out of the running from that standpoint. If they're going to prevail as they have in the past and get the jobs that they often come to college for, they are going to have a superior quality of education. And that's not what you get by studying 14 hours a week and doing that poorly on tests of critical thinking and writing. So government officials have been worrying about this, and they've been trying to decide how to make universities more accountable. And they've tried a variety of things without much success. In the 90s, they tried something called performance budgeting, where they set out a number of outcomes that they felt were important, like GRE test scores or what employers thought of the alumni they hired. And the colleges that did the best job of meeting those outcomes and getting good scores, according to this system, would receive more budget money, and the ones that did worse would receive less budget money. And that would be a good way of, as they say, incentivizing people in the higher education to try harder. That worked with a lot of enthusiasm at first, and many states got on board. But as soon as we got hit with a recession in 2000, everyone gave it up, and it is generally regarded as for a number of reasons I won't go into, to have been a failure. And then, of course, after 2000, you got the George W. Bush administration, and you got a Secretary of Education called Margaret Spellings, and she put together a commission to try to get higher education to shape up. And they had the idea that they would mandate a test like the CLA test that I mentioned, and make every college administer it, and then they would have to publish the findings. And the idea was that as soon as students found that they could learn more about critical thinking at University A than University B, they would flock to University A, and that would put market pressure on University B, and pretty soon competitive pressures would begin to move the whole system up into higher levels of performance. That was met with great hostility from higher education, and was abandoned before it ever saw the light of day. And so you have now a third effort to deal with this through accreditation. The Congress has passed legislation telling the accreditors who come around and visit you once every decade that they should make assessment their first priority. And so probably if you've been accredited here in the last a few years, you've heard a lot of talk about specifying your learning objectives and developing measures for assessing how well those objectives are being achieved. And the jury is still out on how effective that will be at lifting university performance. Now, most universities and their faculties are resisting these efforts, not openly. They're not picketing in the streets, but they're responding the way professors often do so effectively. They're sort of passive resistance. They just don't go along with it. And they have some good reasons. They fear that they're going to be subjected to very crude, standardized tests that don't begin to measure the things they think they're doing for students. They think the government will emphasize skills that have to do with training the workforce and increasing productivity at the expense of other things that matter a great deal about a well-rounded liberal education. They're also afraid that once you start mandating tests, teachers are going to have to teach with the tests in mind, and that's going to erode the freedom of professors to teach the courses in the way they think best. And besides, professors are working longer hours every week than they have in several decades. Professors at a place like UCSD are working an average of over 50 hours a week. And the thought that government is going to come in and do a lot of things and mandate a lot of tests and cause a lot of agonizing reappraisals and redoing your courses is not an appetizing a project for them to contemplate. And so they do resist. But I think that underlying this conflict, the desire of the government to find some way of holding universities accountable and the faculty's resistance to all the ways proposed thus far, really what that reflects deep down, I think, is a very basic clash of cultures. That on the one hand, you have the reformers, and their culture is one that could be called evidence-based approaches to education. They want to measure everything to find out how much progress is being made, what your goals are you meeting them, and ultimately to, if you're not meeting them, to engage in tested experiments that will be rigorously evaluated to try to figure out how you can do better. That clashes head on with the traditional ethos of faculties, who have what might be called a traditional intuitive approach to teaching. Teaching is something that depends on your native talent. It's something you pick up by remembering what the best professors you had taught like. You change it over time due to practical experience and judgment, but it's not something you deal with by assessing and setting objectives or things of that kind. It's a private matter for each professor, and some of us are more gifted than others, but we all kind of learn as we go along by hunch, experience, anecdote, and what have you. Very different approach from the knowledge base, from the evidence-based approach of the reformers. And the faculty have very good reason to be suspicious of evidence-based reform. If you just look at the experience in the public schools under things like No Child Left Behind, you find a lot that makes you genuinely worried. You find that the tests that are used are often very crude and don't do a good job of measuring the more subtle aspects of education. You find that the government, sure enough, is fixated on skills that have to do with improving the economy and don't have much truck with the softer and more subtle values of, let's say, of the humanities. You find that testing diverts the energy of administrators and faculty from the things that can't be tested, that are often very valuable, to the things that can, because tests are now what really counts. And that begins to distort the whole undergraduate program away from the classic ideal, which I think all of us cherish, of a well-rounded liberal education. So one can understand that looking at those results, if that is what is going to be applied to undergraduate education, it should be resisted. But I think as one thinks further, one recognizes that resistance by itself is simply not enough. The limited progress that students are making in skills as vital as critical thinking and writing is just not acceptable. It's not satisfactory. It demands something other than resistance to the government's efforts to do something about it. The decline of studying is genuinely troubling. And I think the faculty response to a 40% decline in students, the amount of hours students spend on their homework, when all the research tells you that what you get out of higher education is a direct product of how much effort you put into it. So a 40% decline is no sort of easy or simple matter. And I don't think many faculty understand that behind all this is a competition that they don't, I don't think the faculty members of my acquaintance really understand they're in, that they are vying with some very determined organizations with very sophisticated people. They're vying and competing for the time and attention of young people. The TV, television producers, the iPods, the computer games, the internet, the texting, the Twittering, the Facebook. I mean, all these are organizations that basically are competing for the time and attention of college-age students, along with a very attractive set of extracurricular temptations that colleges themselves create. So there is a competition, and if you don't know you're in it, you're going to get licked. And that apparently is what has been happening these last 40 years. But what has been the response of universities? They've responded, I think, in two ways. One is they've continued grade inflation. In other words, you're working less, but you're getting better grades. And that's not very encouraging. If I were in the government, I'd be pretty dissatisfied about that, too. And I think the other thing they're doing is they're going along with the students. They're demanding less. Homework assignments are down. We now have quite good statistics on how much on what kinds of homework students have. We discover in one very comprehensive national survey that 50% of seniors have never written a paper that's more than 20 pages long. And that one-third of the students have had no class that demanded more than 40 pages of reading per week. So I think resistance is understandable, but it's not sufficient. And we have to ask how we can reconcile these two conflicting cultures so that something productive can come out of it. I think the government, on its part, has to realize that reform cannot be imposed from above. You can't, you're only going to get educational reform if the professors believe in it, because they're the ones doing the teaching, which means you can't impose a test upon them. It wouldn't fit the diversity of American higher education anyway. And if you impose a single official test of critical thinking, for example, you're going to freeze innovation, experimentation in trying to develop better measures and in favor of a measure, like all measures, which is not as good as we would like it to be. And so you're freezing innovation in a bad way. And faculty members are simply not going to change their methods of teaching in response to some test that they had no part in either devising or accepting. So that won't do. I think the other principle the government has to observe is that tests and testing and assessment and looking at how much progress you're actually making has to be a process that is used for the internal development of an individual college. It shouldn't be made into some kind of competitive horse race in which rewards and penalties and college rankings all depend on some kind of highly publicized scores of one institution compared with others. If you do that, the faculties are sure to resist. The results will be somewhat unfair because the amount of progress one college makes is over another is not necessarily determined by things that are under the college's control. So to hold them responsible is really to do something that is not warranted, because the college certainly affects performance, but it by no means controls all of the things that determine student performance. So, and of course, once you start putting real rewards and penalties on publicized test scores, you're going to divert a lot of energy into gaming the system and finding ways of getting your students to do better than they really are on the tests, and all kinds of unfortunate things are going to come out, and you're going to emphasize the subjects that are going to be tested and slight the important subjects that can't be. So that's a bad idea. But faculties, on their part, cannot reject assessment as impossible, as I have heard faculty members do, to say there's no way of assessing the kinds of subtle things that I'm trying to get my students to understand. I mean, professors assess learning all the time. They call it grading. And they are constantly assessing how much their students have learned. And it is true that some legitimate goals of undergraduate education are hard to measure. But there's a lot that can be measured fairly readily. You certainly can measure improvement in writing. You can measure proficiency in a foreign language. You can measure the amount of learning that goes on in subjects that have definite answers, like math and statistics and much of science. I think you can do a pretty good job of measuring critical thinking. So there's a lot of important things that you can measure, and we shouldn't try to deny that that is so. You can also do some very interesting things at the level of individual courses. I thought I'd just give you two quick examples. I have a friend at Harvard called Eric Mazur, who teaches basic physics. He was a very successful teacher. He got high student ratings. He had large classes. But something bothered him. He'd read about some other professors who had found their students didn't know as much as they thought, and he was somewhat troubled by some of the questions that his students asked him after class. And so he decided, unlike most of us who, when we hear disturbing things like that, we get over it and go on as we did before, he decided, I'm going to put this to a test. So he devised a very simple exam that if you really understood the underlying principles of physics in the course, you would have no difficulty applying these to the somewhat different situations that he described in his test. But if you didn't understand the principles of physics, you would be totally flummoxed. And so he gave the test to the students before they had gone to a single class. And of course, the students did terribly because they knew nothing about physics. So how would they pass this exam? Just what was expected. But then when the class was over, he gave them a test which was almost exactly the same. They did no better the second time than they did before they took the course. And so he had to come to terms with the fact that his students had they relied on their memory to pass the test and even sometimes get very good grades. They memorized all their problem sets and they could kind of figure out whether the questions corresponded to this or that problem they remember solving. But they didn't really understand anything that was fundamentally important. Well, that was a very interesting thing to know. And I think if more professors tried to use assessment in their own courses, you would find some other interesting things. Another wonderful example, which is probably one of the most influential tests ever made in America, was made by a young person. I think he was a graduate student or instructor at Berkeley, Yuri Treisman, who wondered why his black students did so much worse than his Asian students in introductory calculus. So he, unlike most people who teach calculus, he decided to play anthropologist. He kind of padded around and observed how these students went about studying the course, and he found a very interesting thing, that the Asian students studied in groups, and if one of them didn't understand, the other, would work with them until they figured out why one of the students was having such a hard time, and they'd kind of overcome whatever mental block the student was having, and they would get back in the swing of things. The black students studied alone, and when they reached an assignment that for some reason they had some kind of a block and couldn't deal with, they got discouraged, and they began to get further and further behind, and then ultimately dropped out or did very badly in the course. But then he didn't stop there. I wish we had more people like him. He said, well, I'm going to do an experiment. I'm going to have the black students study in groups just like everybody else, and I teach more than one section. So I had one section made up of study groups, and I had another section which people were free, just as they had been in the past, to study any way they wanted. And there were dramatic improvements. The black students got much better grades. They dropped out of science much less frequently. They graduated at higher rates. It was quite a remarkable performance. But I simply cited to illustrate the kinds of interesting things that you can do if you set about really trying to discover how much learning is going on in your class. And there are lots of other useful applications. I mean, it would be, one of the interesting things about undergraduate education is that almost every brochure that a college puts out talks about we're educating and preparing informed, enlightened citizens, but almost no curriculum has a single course that has anything really to do with preparing citizens at all. Well, it would be interesting to test that. One person did, with the wonderful name of Sunshine Hillegas, a political scientist. I don't know whether Sunshine is male or female, I'll use the word she and hope for the best. Sunshine did a study of what happened to people for 5 or 6 years after they graduated, and she found a very interesting fact that people who majored in education or majored in engineering, they actually became less involved as citizens, and so much so that with every additional course they took in their major, they tended in later life to be less engaged in their communities and in voting and so forth. Well, that, again, is a very interesting thing to know. Instead of just asserting that we are turning out enlightened citizens, here we find a rather serious qualification to that proposition. There are all sorts of things about how you students use electives. Do distribution requirements really create a breadth of interests or not? Could all be tested, and yet they very seldom are, at least in the institutions that I know about. To me, the ultimate goal is to create a climate of investigation. Not that you're assessing everything all the time, but that in some systematic way, at whatever pace you want, you kind of go through the things you do and try to find out, wherever possible, what are the assumptions that we're making? What are the purposes we're trying to achieve? And can we find out whether we're actually achieving them? And then when you do that, you discover weak points, and hopefully you then experiment with ways of overcoming the weaknesses, and gradually through enlightened trial and error, you get better. Well, how utopian is that? I mean, that's my vision of what I would like colleges to be doing in the years to come. And I may sound like a Pollyanna, I believe, despite the faculty resistance that you encounter in many places, that that is the way we're heading, and that is that kind of an experimental, inquiring environment is the one that is going to take the place of what we have now. In fact, I think change in that direction is already underway, although it's not terribly visible. If you look carefully at what's going on and the way students are being taught, you see much more of this than you did, say, 20 years ago. And the principal reason I think change will occur in a positive direction is that the traditional intuitive way of teaching actually is in conflict with at least two much deeper values that professors have. The first is their feeling about why they're teaching. Most people become professors because they really believe and believe in helping young people to develop their talents and capabilities as much as they can. It's simply you read a lot in the paper about professors, particularly at places like this, who don't really care about teaching. They only care about their research. That is a false canard. There are professors that way, but they are not in the majority. I mean, the faculty spend on average twice as much time teaching in the United States as they do on their research. Most faculty members will say that they are more interested in their teaching than their research. That isn't true in research universities, but even in research universities, 40% of the faculty say they're more interested in their teaching than in their research. American professors, interestingly enough, are more interested and say they're more interested in teaching than the professors of any other advanced country in the world. And so you have a basic value there of going into this profession because you believe in helping students progress, and yet the way in which you're going about your teaching and your unwillingness to subject it to real inquiry is causing you to teach in ways that do not have the results that you think. That there are other professors out there like Eric Mazur who will find that they're not helping their students progress nearly as much. And that represents a real conflict with one of their basic values. The intuitive approach, the traditional intuitive approach, is also at war with another basic value, and that is the way in which professors normally go about a lot of the problems that they face in their professional life, namely in their research. In their research, the professor is always very careful to identify a problem, to gather all the relevant evidence, to think of possible solutions that seem plausible in light of the evidence, and then test them rigorously to try to find the one that fits the evidence most precisely. That's not at all the way professors go about their teaching. They begin by copying professors that they had when they were students, and they change through, as life goes on, through random episodes that give them some kind of insight on students, or maybe they get something out of some of the exams they grade, if they grade exams, there are chance conversations that may cause them to try something new. But it's nothing like the kind of careful, systematic way in which they approach problems in the other half of their professional life, a mode of inquiry and of rigor in which they believe very deeply. So there again, you have a conflict between the way that professors are behaving toward their teaching and their deeper values about how you ought to approach serious problems that you want to get to the bottom of. And in my view, it is by exposing the conflict between the actual current practice and the deeper beliefs and values of professors that you're going to bring change about. I think that's the way change often occurs in society. If you think of two very familiar examples of how our attitudes have changed toward race and gender, the discrimination on the basis of race and gender was always opposed to very deep values in America about equal opportunity and the equal dignity of human beings. But the clash or the difference between the practice of discrimination and these deeper values was obscured for a long time by a whole series of kind of casual rationalizations which people trotted it out. Well, you know, blacks are shiftless and lazy, and women have delicate temperaments that makes them unsuited for various occupations, and they have family responsibilities that make them unreliable employees, and so it went until there was enough determined publicity that made people face up to the fact that there was a real conflict between the way women and minorities were being treated and the deeper values that America holds dear. And it was when that conflict became exposed that change began to come about, and has come about, I think, more rapidly than many people would have believed possible, at least of my generation. And I think the same thing can happen in college teaching. I mean, just to use two quick examples. Back in the 70s, I gave a writing test to find out how much progress Harvard students were making in writing. And we devised a very careful test, and we carried it out and looked at the results. And some of them were gratifying and not altogether surprising. We found that people who had majored in the humanities had made a great deal of progress in the quality of the writing, the clarity, the grace of which they expressed themselves, and so forth. We found that people who majored in social sciences had made a good deal of progress, though not as much as the majors in humanities. And then that was all pretty much expected, but then we found the most curious and interesting thing, that the people who'd majored in science wrote worse as seniors than they had when they entered as freshmen. Now, when I brought those results to the departments, I didn't have to lecture them about their obligations to teach writing. The moment they saw that, they knew something has to be done. And it was very gratifying when I got called back into service again in 2006 to be president for 18 months. I decided, what the heck, I'll run the whole test again. And I found that scientists really wrote much better as seniors than they did as freshmen. So the lesson had been taken apart to heart. But I think it simply indicates the fact that nothing special had to be done the moment the conflict was exposed. People knew immediately, we got to fix that. And they did. And I think faculties everywhere will fix it if they see that what they hoped was the case is not really the case in terms of the amounts their students are learning. And I think what is going on in the United States today is bound to expose these conflicts and make the conflicts more and more apparent. I mean, you now, as I say, had 500 schools taking this test of critical thinking and writing that I mentioned at the beginning. The results have just been published in a book. Its book's got quite a bit of publicity. Bob Herbert in the New York Times devoted an entire column to it. So people are beginning to see, including professors, that, something's wrong here. We all talk. I mean, 95% of us say this is the most important thing, this critical thinking. And look, 36% of students aren't doing. Maybe I ought to check here to see whether my students at Harvard or UCSD are making progress. And they're likely to find yes, but not as much progress as they had thought, and that's going to worry them. The study documenting the decline in the amount of homework going on has also been extensively covered in the New York Times and elsewhere, and professors are going to read that. The accreditors are pressing all universities, including this one and mine, to define their learning objectives carefully and then to assess progress toward them. And as they bully us into doing that, results are going to kind of trickle out, and professors are going to want to know, well, what happened when we assessed these things, and they're going to find a conflict between what they hoped to be true and what is actually true about their students' learning. And they're going to learn, I think, quite quickly that if you really believe overwhelmingly that critical thinking is the most important thing you can teach undergraduates, you better stop making lecturing your main form of teaching, because there's a mountain of evidence that says that's not the, if you want to make people think, the way to try to accomplish that is not to give them lectures any more than the way to teach people how to drive is to lecture them in an auditorium about exactly, you know, how the car works and what you do with the steering wheel. I think this process is already visible. If you look carefully, there are statistics. The lecturing is still the most prevalent form of teaching in undergraduate education, but it's losing ground all the time. There's more problem-solving and problem-based instruction. There's more collaborative learning. There's more student research. There's more service learning. Lots of new ways that are probably more successful, are beginning to replace the standard lecture format. I regret to say that leading universities, the greatest universities in this country, are not leading in this effort, especially the great private universities. They have reasons for not participating actively. They have masses of students, so they don't have to worry about improving to get students. They have very fine reputations. They don't like the idea of beginning to have assessments that will surely leak out into the papers, and they can envisage and I've gone through this myself, the thought of staying awake at night thinking of those newspaper stories, students at Harvard are learning nothing. It's a very sobering thought when you charge the tuitions that we do. And so obviously the idea of assessment is not a very popular one. I think that's a pity. Progress would toward the kind of, approach to learning that will serve us best in the long run will come about more slowly if the leading universities are not active participants, because the leading universities have a lot of visibility and they command a lot of followers among other colleges. But I'm convinced that whether or not they are in the vanguard, progress is going to come anyway. There's going to be continued pressure by the accrediting people to do more and more assessment. There's going to be more publicity, like the book that's just been written about these composite results, without naming names of universities, the composite results of how much students are progressing in critical thinking and in writing. There's going to be professors are going to hear about assessments being carried on. They're going to want to know what the results were. And so the conflicts between reality and the underlying values of the professoriate are going to become more and more visible over time, and it's going to become more uncomfortable not to change. And so in the end, and this is my fondest hope, I may be losing my grip on reality here, but my fondest hope is that faculty everywhere will someday come to regard teaching as they do research, as a succession of very challenging and interesting problems that they can explore systematically and eventually overcome as institutions and in their own individual classes. If that should occur, I think the coming generation may well be looked back upon someday as one of great creative change that rivals the other great periods of creative change in American higher education, the decades immediately after the Civil War and the decades immediately after World War II, in which this university participated so gloriously. So I have perhaps not mentioned the great virtues of liberal arts education, although I believe in them thoroughly. I hope I've not disappointed my hosts in not dwelling upon that so many people have talked about more eloquently than I. But I am, I think, talking about preserving them and making them as effective as possible. And to me, the shortcomings are really opportunities in disguise. They're opportunities even for UCSD to make as much progress in a different way in your second 50 years as you have in your first. And they have the great advantage, particularly in the state of California, that these are reforms among the whole gamut of American higher education reforms that really cost the least money. You can do a great deal along the lines that I've mentioned for very small expense. And if we do that at Harvard, at UCSD, at colleges across the land, I really think it will be a triumph for us, a triumph for our students, and for everyone who has a stake in the quality of higher education in this country. So thank you again for inviting me, and I deeply appreciate the honor.
I'd like to find out what your opinion of virtual universities and virtual classrooms are in the future. Where do you see them, and what do you see the direction?
You mean distance education, computer-based education? Or?
Yes, exactly.
Well, I think it's really quite a bright future. There was a long time when we believed that computer-based education did as well as sort of face-to-face education in the traditional manner, but it wasn't any better. And if you made it as good, it would cost as much as if you taught in the traditional way. There's been a lot of new research that has shown that although on average online education is about as good but not significantly better or significantly worse than traditional education, but if you break it down, you find a really remarkable thing. You find there are some forms of and some experiments very carefully conducted experiments in computer-based education, internet-based distance education that are up to 50% better than normal education, and there are others that are 50% less. So the average comes out equal, but there's obviously opportunities here to figure out how you do 50% better. Let me just mention one because I think it's very interesting, and I think it's another example of why I think a more systematic approach to higher education will ultimately prevail. It's a course in statistics by Carnegie Mellon, although they've done similar courses in a number of other fields. And what it is, and this is where I think the future lies, it's in a so-called blended course. It's not all taught by computer, but it has a lot of computer in it. And what it does is that the professors lecture only about half the time. The students work in groups on computers with graduate students there to help them if they get stuck. And through a combination of a few lectures and a lot of group work by students on computers, they do the rest of the work of the course. The wonderful thing about the computers that they're working at, which I think opens up all kinds of fascinating things for the future, is that the Carnegie Mellon folks who put $500,000 into developing this course relied on a long period of research on how people learn statistics and what kinds of mental blocks they have. And they have programmed this computer so that the computer can detect when one of the learning blocks is interfering with the a student's responses, and instantly it branches into a series of questions that are designed to show you what the block is and how to avoid it. So for the first time, you're getting a computer that actually adapts to different people's learning styles and learning difficulties and asks different questions of them than it does to people who don't have these problems. Well, the nice thing they did is that they having done this, they did a fairly careful study of one group of students who took the traditional statistics course and one group that took it with this blended computer added form. The first thing they found that was interesting is that the students completed the course in half the time, not because they worked twice as hard. They studied only as much per week as usual, but in this format, they completed the full course in half the time. They found they comprehended statistics slightly better than they did in the regular course. They then did something I haven't seen before. I think it was very ingenious. They tested them 18 months later to see how much they retained. And they found that the students who'd taken the blended computer-aided course retain more than the students who had taken the traditional course. And then just to cap it all off, if that weren't attractive enough, they found that you save a substantial amount of money by teaching your introductory course in this fashion. And I think there's a whole wave now of computer-assisted courses in which major savings are going to be made in the costs of introductory courses, not only in statistics, but in a whole range of other subjects. So I think that's the most exciting frontier. And now we're testing the Carnegie Mellon model on all of the, or at least most of the public universities in the University of Maryland system and the New York system. That's going to be a huge number of students. And if those results hold up, I'm sure the teaching of introductory statistics across the United States is going to change pretty radically, because the ability to improve student learning and save a lot of money in the process is a package, really, no matter how much of a troglodyte you are, you're going to find that appealing. So
faculty advancements are judged, I think, pretty much in all universities on the basis of teaching, research, and service. Yep. And I was curious what your perspective is on how teaching effectiveness measures can be used to evaluate faculty for advancements, because at least here at UCSD, the way it's done is purely on the basis of student surveys that sure. tend to support popular professors who may not teach the students anything sure. at all. And that may be one of the reasons why the amount of homework is going down and all these other things.
Yeah, and it can be quite dangerous, because there is some evidence on the books that suggests that you are you get better student ratings by giving easier classes. And so if you look at the response that I mentioned to less homework, which is, you know, that's the response that you get when you feel student pressure for easier courses. So definitely unfortunate. I think the whole assessment movement is going to make it easier to give teaching more importance, because you're going to have much better evidence of what is effective teaching and what is not. And you're going to be able to distinguish people who are making a real contribution through helping to develop innovative ways of teaching, so that you're going to come close to that some classic book that was written by the late Ernie Boyer, that we should be evaluating different forms of scholarship, and one of them was the scholarship of teaching. I found that a well-meaning but very fuzzy term. But when you talk about really beginning to evaluate different forms of teaching, I think you begin to see a basis for giving weight to teaching that you simply haven't had when you had to rely on anecdote or student evaluations and there was no kind of direct evidence. So I would say I can't predict how far it will go, but I'm sure there will be more attention paid to the quality of teaching. Whether it would ever equal research, I don't know. Research is so powerful. But I think it's going to go some distance in that direction, and that will be a very healthy thing, I think.
President Bach, I'm prepared if you don't agree with me, because you're one of the universe's greatest thinkers, I think. And we're only about 3 years apart. You'll remember these numbers. When I went to college, 1 year, room, board, and tuition, $2,000. Today,
yes.
Today, $52,500. I have felt a long time that 3 years of education at the undergraduate level is sufficient. Mm-hmm. It's like a steak. A 10-ounce steak is wonderful, but you can fill up on 7.5 ounces as well. And I'm wondering if you would address this, plus the inflation in education costs is higher than medical costs, and what, if anything, can be done about it? Thank you.
You want to address the whole idea of escalating college costs.
That plus whether you can do the job in 3 years.
Well, I mean, you can certainly do something in 3 years, but I must say I oppose that proposal because I can see, unless an awful lot of effort is put in and there's a lot of change of heart, I can see what's going to happen. How are you going to shrink undergraduate education by 1 year? Well, are you going to shrink the major that is beloved by all departments and beloved by the vocational majors, at least? Many students believe is the only really valuable part of their education. I think you might do a little, but I don't think you're going to. The forces arrayed against shrinking the major are very strong. Are you going to shrink electives? Well, students love electives, and so that's going to be kind of an unpopular move. So I fear it's going to squeeze even more the remaining part of the education that goes into general education. General education is already getting, I think, far too little space in the curriculum. General education is where the whole idea of promoting intellectual breadth takes place. It's where teaching people writing takes place. It's where teaching people foreign languages takes place. Teaching something people call, that I don't quite understand, global competence to function better in an interdependent world in which your life is going to be more affected by events beyond the United States. Quantitative literacy, citizenship, moral development, all these things, you're debating another purpose that will be shoved in there as we speak at UCSD, and that is whether you should have a course on some kind of civility or racial understanding and tolerance. And yet I think that's the part of the university that is most weakly defended. And so I think shrinking to 3 years is just going to bring us further from having the curricular space to achieve some very worthy objective. So I would deplore its passing. I understand the concern about college costs. I don't find generalizations about college costs going up faster and tuition going up faster than inflation very helpful. In the first place, there are so many different colleges and the prices vary enormously. I mean, the price of some college is something like $5,000 a year, and in other places it's $25,000 or $30,000, and that's not including room and board. The idea of college costs is also, I think, misunderstood in many places, particularly in the public sector, because people do not realize that the reason the tuitions are going up this way is not just because the college costs are going up. It's because the state is giving a diminishing proportion of the budgets of these institutions in aid. It's in California, over the years they've given more and more to prisons and less to higher education, and eventually you're faced with a cruel choice. Either you cut the quality or the financial aid or something else valuable in order to make up for the lowering of state aid, or you raise tuition. And I think most state colleges have been reluctant to diminish the quality, and so they've tended to raise tuition. But that, I think, to blame the colleges for that is difficult, because the prime cause has been the reduction in state support. Also, a lot of the debate just doesn't look at the effect of financial aid. And for example, I know when I came back into office in 2007, I was interested in what had really happened to the cost of going to Harvard over the last 10 years. And I found that the real cost of going to Harvard as a percentage of people's taxable income, of their discretionary income, the percentage had gone down over the last, the sticker price had gone up quite rapidly. The actual burden had, in terms of what percentage of your income are you going to have to pay to send a child to college, had gone down for every class of students except those in the very highest wealth category. And there, of course, the incomes have been going up very, very rapidly. And I think the increase even for them was, as a percentage of their income, was infinitesimal. For a number of students, it had gone down. For example, I don't mean everyone has emulated this, but nobody who makes, whose family makes $60,000 or less has to pay a dime at Harvard now. And if you look at people making, I don't know what the cutoff is, but it's way up, 190,000, 200 and some thousand, until you get way up in the scale, you only have to pay 10% of your income. You're guaranteed that you have to pay no more than that. So I'm not holding out Harvard as typical, but no university is really typical. They're all over the map, and you really, I don't mean to complicate the answer to the question, but you really have to look at each institution and see what has happened to its costs and take account of financial aid, because that affects the real cost of the actual out-of-pocket cost that people are charged. So I'm sure there are a lot of colleges that are charge a lot more, and that's created a fair amount of hardship. I think there are other colleges that haven't. A very large number of colleges have not increased their real income, taking account of financial aid over the last decade. Surprising number have not. So you have to be very careful about it. But I think in the end, you have just one other thing that I'd mentioned for an overly long answer, and that is what's happened in higher education is not unique. If you look at any services in this country which are heavily provided for by highly educated people, whether it's medical services, legal services, insurance, numbers of things like that, they all have a cost trajectory, just like universities. The reason it's hard in those businesses to find productivity, ways of increasing productivity and lowering costs in that fashion. I mean, the classic case, of course, is the Beethoven Quartet. Nobody's ever figured out a way to play the Beethoven Quartet with only three instrumentalists. And universities are obviously not quite that way. But it's hard not to diminish quality. A lot of places have cut their costs of going to college by hiring not tenure-track professors, research-oriented professors, but part-time adjuncts. There's a lot of evidence that hiring adjuncts exerts an unfortunate pressure on your graduation rates, for example. So you're paying a cost in quality by keeping the price down. So I know this is not a satisfactory answer. You're out there, you see things happening, you look at the price now, you say, my God, you know, what I used to pay was so much less. it just becomes more complicated if you take account of financial aid and all the other things that I've mentioned. And so I think you really have to look at individual colleges and see what they've done. And some have done better than others. But at least in the case of my university, what looks like a huge increase in price works out as no increase at all in terms of the percentage of income that people have to pay to go there. And for some, at the lower end of the scale, their college costs have been significantly reduced over the last 10 years. You never get that out of just looking at tuitions.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you, and I right. hope you'll come back and talk about graduate school.
So, yeah.
so I can tell you that I think
about
2
what?
Years of law school is enough.
I see. Well, No, don't quote me because I'll be called a traitor to my class, but I think if I had to pick a place to take a year off of, I'd take it out of law school. I'm not out of the college.
Dr. Bach, if I may, speaking in the language of business, my view of things is that perhaps in this post-civil rights era, we've seen a much closer relationship between the business world and the university campus. And I'm wondering if, in your view, that's something that needs to be remedied. If this blending of our corporate yeah. sector with the academic, or let's say the university,
university
professoriate, yeah, this sort of blending of these two cultures that we've yeah. seen in recent years, is that something that is helping us to produce better students, or is that something that's actually hindering the higher learning experience?
Well, I think what is happening in higher education now is that we are adding a new basic purpose to universities. I mean, we started out by just being teaching institutions centuries ago, and then we added research, and then we were increasingly asked to help in various ways in our communities and elsewhere, and so we added service. So most people would say we have three basic missions: teaching, research, service. I think a fourth is now being added with a lot of encouragement from state and federal government, and that is for universities to assist in the process of economic development. And I think you look at the kinds of entire industries that have sprung out of university research, and you become very anxious to try to facilitate and to speed up the process of translating discoveries in university laboratories into useful products and services, which is, after all, why taxpayers support research in such lavish amounts. I can understand that pressure. I think we should try to do that as universities. It's important to people, and goodness knows if that's clearly what the taxpayer would like out of their money, we should help them get it. I mean, that's a simple obligation. It poses a lot of risks for universities. Once you get involved in close cooperation with corporations, you are mixing two different cultures. There's a risk that your scientists will be diverted excessively into doing practical things, and that basic research, out of which much progress in the long run develops, will suffer. There's dangers of conflicts of interest. There's dangers of misusing students by getting students to work on commercial projects. There's danger of rewarding professors by encouraging them to start up their own companies and get patents and patent share and patent royalties. Professors may be diverted away from things they do best into things they think they can make money at. Those are all real dangers. I think the dangers can be managed. I think thus far the worst fears that people had, that research will somehow be blighted and distorted because of closer ties to business, have not borne fruit. Scientists believe most of all not in making money, but in doing good science, and that's held up very well despite the closer relationships with corporations. What I think has suffered, however, is that particularly when you get into things like conflict of interest. You get professors beginning to speak out on issues in which they actually have a financial interest. And that becomes known. And suddenly something very precious begins to be lost. People say, well, I thought professors were impartial experts, but actually I read about all these cases in which they really stood to gain financially by standing up for this issue or not. I mean, you find people who, professors who come out in favor of that global warming isn't such a big problem, and then you find out later that they were really getting a handsome retainer from coal companies. And I have nothing against coal companies, and I don't want to get into a debate on global warming, but I think when professors are seen to make money out of the public statements that they make, a very valuable source of objective information is being threatened. So I think there's some very real risks that remain and that we should be much more vigilant in trying to contain those risks. But overall, I think we've done pretty well in adopting this fourth mission of speeding economic development. I think it's inevitable, and we must learn to live with it. I just hope we have the moral backbone to do that in a way that doesn't end up harming some very precious intangible values that higher education ought to hold dear.
I think that Chancellor Fox mentioned that while you were at Harvard, public service went up significantly. I haven't looked at any statistics, but it seems to me that part of the reason that studying time has decreased is because of the increasing pressure to participate in more extracurriculars and public service. As a high school senior who's about to go to college, I was wondering what you think about the relative importance of academic studying versus extracurricular participation. Yeah, so what do you think about the importance of extracurriculars versus academic studying?
Well, again, I think all things in moderation. I mean, I think one of the great triumphs of undergraduate education in this country is that we have succeeded in a great many colleges of giving students a memorable 4 years in which they have learned, not as much as I would like, not as much as I think we can help them learn, but they've certainly learned a lot. They've learned an awful lot from outside of the classroom by interacting with other students and by trying on all sorts of identities and figuring out who they are and how they can live independently. I mean, I think that comes more from outside the classroom than from inside it. I think there are a lot of extracurricular activities that are really quite valuable. I do believe in trying to prepare undergraduates to be active, informed, enlightened, engaged citizens. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that it's the students who get involved in extracurricular activities, student government and things like that, that has a more powerful effect on their later life involvement in the community and in public service than taking a course on the subject. So I think some of that is fine. Like everything, I think it has to be done in moderation. I am not, for example, I'm not in favor of all extracurricular activities. I think some of them may come at the expense of studies. I think that some of them are downright harmful. I think, quite frankly, big-time college athletics is a blight on the face of higher education. It's a form of institutionalized corruption that I think is deeply, deeply unsettling. It's one of the things where we really got off the track, and I think the amount of time students have to put into it, the way in which we compromise academic standards to win on the athletic field is really a shame. So, once again, like all my answers, I've made things more complicated. I think it depends on the amount of time you devote to extracurricular activities. It depends on the kind of extracurricular activities. But to some extent, done in moderation, I think extracurricular activities are wonderful. It's one of the things that sets us apart from colleges and universities in Europe, where it's pretty much you don't have an extracurricular life. You get an apartment in the city and you go to class, and that's all that you do with the university, and your private life is entirely your own. I think by organizing all these activities, we've made college a much more enjoyable experience. And I think 4 years of people's lives, that's an important thing to have done. So, like everything else, we have to manage it carefully. But in principle, I think it's a good thing. And I think it's only when you get out in the extremes or in a few of the bad cases like athletics that it's gotten off the track. So I would give it thumbs up overall.
Yes. So I just want to take one more opportunity tonight to thank Chancellor Marianne Fox for being with us tonight, Council of Provost and Helen Edison Lecture Series for sponsoring this evening, and of course especially President Derek Bach for an extremely thought-provoking lecture. Thank you for coming. Thank you for joining us here in San Diego. And thank you all for being here this evening.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.